Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone, and you may withdraw yourself from the queue by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded. It's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Guillermo Cantor. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I'm Guillermo Cantor, Senior Policy Analyst at the American Immigration Council, and we're on this call today with three very respected scholars to discuss some of the findings of the Migrant Border Crossing Study. This study is based on a very comprehensive survey with recently repatriated migrants who were interviewed in six Mexican cities between the years 2009 and 2012. The two reports we are going to hear about today expose some very serious abuses that are systematically experienced by migrants while being in U.S. custody. As our speakers will show us, these abuses appear to be closely linked to a lack of transparency and accountability in U.S. customs and border protection. The reports are available on our website, immigrationpolicy.org. And the speakers today are Daniel Martinez, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at George Washington University. Then we'll have Jeremy Slack, who is a doctoral candidate in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. And in third place, we have Joe Heyman, who is a professor of anthropology and the chair of the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Texas, El Paso. And before we start with the presentations, I want to note that this call is being recorded. We'll start with Daniel Martinez, who is going to give us a brief introduction to the study, as well as an overview of the first report, which is titled Taken and Not Returned. So, Daniel, please go ahead.
Sure. Hi, everybody, and thanks for joining us. I'm just going to talk real briefly about some of the methods used to collect these data and the uniqueness of the data set, and then I'll go into some of the possessions, the results on the possession report. So I want to start by just indicating, sharing with you that the data collected in the Migrant Border Crossing Study come from a systematic random sample of recently repatriated migrants in six Mexican cities, right, in Tijuana, in Mexicali, in Nogales, Juarez, Nuevo Laredo, and in Mexico City. Now, in order, and as Guillermo indicated, all surveys were carried out in these six cities between 2009 and 2012, with the bulk of the surveys being collected in 2011. In order to be eligible to participate in the study, a respondent must have crossed the border in a post 9/11 era, been apprehended by any U.S. authority, and repatriated to Mexico less than a month prior to being surveyed. Now, what makes our data set unique is that we spoke to people immediately following their deportation while still near the border, rather than waiting to speak with them in their communities of origin several months or even years after the last deportation. Now, this methodological approach helps ensure the quality, reliability, and validity of people's responses about their crossing and deportation experience and decreases retrospective bias. Again, I want to stress that our findings and recommendations stem from a rigorous social scientific methodology. In other words, our results and recommendations are not based on anecdotal accounts, but rather are evidence-based. So now I'm going to begin now by discussing part two of the series, Possessions Taken and Not Returned. As the title implies, the report focuses on the issue of repatriated migrants' belongings being taken and not returned by U.S. authorities. We find that this is not this issue of having people's belongings taken and not returned. We find it's not a random occurrence, but rather appears to be a systematic practice. For instance, over one-third of MBCS respondents indicate that they had some of their belongings taken and not returned, including money, identification, jewelry, medication, and clothing. Further, we find that roughly about 70% of our respondents reported traveling with Mexican identifying documents. Okay, so about 70% of the entire sample said, yes, I had a Mexican ID or CURP or some form of Mexican identifying document. Among this group, roughly 26%, one in four, report having their identification taken and not returned upon deportation. Now, this raises serious concerns, as migrants are often deported to unfamiliar border towns just as far from the community of origin as their hometowns, often in the middle of the night. Now, without proper ID, it's difficult for people to receive money transfers, secure employment, or even board an airplane. So this is really a problematic practice. We also find that the people who are processed through Operation Streamline, for those of you that don't know, is a mass immigration, federal immigration trial aimed at assigning a criminal charge for unauthorized entry and reentry. So people who are processed through Operation Streamline report having their possessions taken and not returned at higher rates when compared to people processed through other programs. In a similar vein, people who are detained for a week or longer also report losing their possessions at higher rates. We find that this problem stems from a lack of interagency standardization and cooperation when it comes to immigrant detainee transfers, particularly between Customs and Border Protection, Bureau of Prisons, and states' Department of Corrections. Ultimately, the transfer of migrants between agencies that have different policies, standards, and practices for handling possessions is the most likely explanation for these important differences. Finally, in terms of people's possessions being taken and not returned, we find notable variation between Border Patrol sector, right? So with people processed through the Paso sector reporting having their possessions lost at a much higher rate than any other sector. Again, this likely is a result of increased use of Operation Streamline and longer periods of detention for migrants in the sector. Now, I just want to conclude real quick by mentioning that in its current form, the Senate bill, S-77, would expand Operation Streamline across the entire border and triple it in the Tucson sector. Now, this will undoubtedly exacerbate the problems of people's possessions being taken and not returned unless special care is given to address these interagency shortcomings. So with that, I think we'll go ahead. I'll turn it back to Guillermo, and Guillermo can introduce the next speaker.
Wonderful. Daniel, thank you so much.
You bet.
So next, we're going to hear Jeremy Slack, whose presentation will focus on the mistreatment of migrants while in custody. So Jeremy, please, if you don't mind, go ahead.
Hi, thank you, everyone. I'm joining you here from a migrant shelter, actually, in the South Texas border region. And I want to give you a brief overview of our first report in the series, actually, called Migrant Mistreatment While in U.S. Custody. Now, this has been a hotly debated topic for quite some time, and we have some new data that can break down a little bit more what's going on in terms of what's being reported by migrants about what types of mistreatment they went through and experienced in U.S. custody. One of the most important things to understand about this report is, as Dan mentioned, this is not a study where we go and ask for people who have experiences with abuses. We do a random sample where we don't ask for volunteers. We approach people at certain intervals, and we try and ask about their experiences in a systematic way. Because of this, we're very confident in the data. Moreover, we found that about 1 in 10 people experienced a form of physical abuse from U.S. authorities during their previous time in custody. And this has been repeated fairly consistently by other people as well along the border. So in a study of Salvadoran deportees by Scott Phillips, Nestor Rodriguez, and Jacqueline Hagen, they found similar rates of abuse, as well as the report by the activist organization No More Deaths. And for people to understand, this type of repetitive, consistent level of abuse of 1 in 10 people is very disturbing, because it really suggests this is not isolated incidents. This is institutional-level problems. Okay, so having this question, this is just not a question of a few bad apples. This is a systematic and consistent problem at an institutional level. Moreover, when we see the increases both that have occurred in the Border Patrol and the increases that are being proposed right now, these have created a lot of tensions along the border, and this is particularly true about several lethal incidents wherein people have been shot while in Mexico or people that have been killed while trying to cross, and this has to do with specific policies about what Border Patrol are allowed to do and not allowed to do, specifically the issue of rock throwers, which people have contested highly, but it's been sort of rejected as something that they should not do by Border Patrol Chief Mike Fisher. And so looking into the different ways people have reacted in terms of recommendations for the Border Patrol in terms of increased training and increased oversight, we conclude that training is not simply enough, because this isn't a level of individual. This is just a question of individuals behaving, a question of the institution of culture is. And similar to with possessions issue, we suggest that there be more transparency and oversight. One of the biggest problems I have when I'm talking to people who report an abuse is that there's really no way for them to complain, to find any sort of justice in these things, because everything is kept behind this wall of Homeland Security. And so we really suggest that there be the Border Patrol be brought back into the community as a police force that it is. Thank you so much, and I'll pass it on to the next person for comment.
Great.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you, Jeremy. And finally, now we're going to take our attention to Joe Tamer, who will provide an overview of some of the overarching themes, as well as give us some insights on what the policy implications are of the some of the issues that were addressed here. So please, Professor Tamer, go ahead.
Yes, thank you to everybody, and thank you to the to Daniel and Jeremy for putting together this very important, publicly important, as well as scientifically important study. This is a crucial turning point. We're talking about an enormous group of officers who have been hired into the Border Patrol and throughout Customs and Border Protection in recent years. We're talking about legislative plans where the quality of their work and the effectiveness of their work is crucially at stake in the legislative questions. In what ways are we really contributing to the security of the American public and of all of the people who move through the border, including border communities? And what are future legislative plans going to involve in the way of effective and responsible enforcement? It's crucial that Customs and Border Protection admit that there are problems. The organization needs to end its tendency to ignore or hide and resist change. We think it's absolutely essential that there be measures in forthcoming congressional legislation addressing oversight and accountability for border enforcement agencies. There needs to be involvement of external stakeholders, community organizations, and criminal justice professionals from outside of DHS. Something that Jeremy mentioned is crucial is complaint reports. In addition to effective complaint processes and individual complaint access to individual complaint outcomes, to really make a difference in the organizational culture, there need to be periodic reports that report complaint patterns and lay out responses by CBP. There need to be metrics for effective response and knowing when responses have been achieved. There needs to be evaluation of officers and managers. There need to be consequences at all levels, and there needs to be more transparency about effective evaluation and consequences. One of the problems that's seen in the area of use of force, but this extends across the organization, is lack of transparency about these processes. Supervision and management are absolutely essential to changing an organizational culture, and so we need to have public involvement with and congressional regulation over supervision and management at Customs and Border Protection. There are training measures both at the Border Patrol Academy and the Customs Inspector Academies, but also a great number of post-academy training processes to monitor and reinforce these sorts of lessons. We need to address how officers conduct themselves in interacting with other people, need to avoid negative judgmental actions and language towards migrants, how people can conduct themselves officers can conduct themselves in situations of stress, boredom, and frustration. They need to be appropriate representatives of the American public in the border region. And finally, we need to have transparency about the process of how changes are going to be brought about. Finally, I want to underscore some important specific recommendations having to do with possessions and identifications. We need to have a uniform set of policies and procedures for the handling and movement of possessions for immigration detainees, and that is overall that follows the immigration detainees through the whole process rather than being agency by agency. We found a lot of stuff is lost because of different policies and different procedures and different agencies, and things get lost in transiting from one agency to another. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kamen, and thank you all for your very insightful presentation. And now I would like to open the floor for questions and answers. And I just want to note that during the Q&A segment, we'll also be joined by my colleague Mary Kenny from our Legal Action Center, who can provide additional background on the legal issues and consequences raised by this study. And so if anyone has a question, please go ahead.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touchtone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touchtone phone, and we'll pause a few moments to allow any questions to enter the queue. And we'll take a first question from Linda Valdez with Arizona Republic. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my question. You mentioned that you need some congressional oversight and some changes at the congressional level, and I'm wondering if there are proposals out there, and if not, who are you looking to introduce some?
Right. This is Joe Hyman. There are proposals. There was some language in the Senate bill about a oversight and accountability task force. That would include northern and southern border regional participants. And there has been also some language in a bill that was reported out of the House Homeland Security Committee. We think that there are good models for language in forthcoming legislation that involve border communities in working with CBP as consultative body on oversight and accountability. I myself have articulated with Congressman O'Rourke in El Paso, and I think he's going to be working with a number of other border congressmen. Vela Grijalva are two that immediately come to mind, and I think that that is one group that has really focused on the border oversight and accountability provisions.
The bill that came out of the House Homeland Security Committee, who was behind that bill? What was that bill?
The House Homeland Oversight bill set up some measures for effectiveness of border security, and it was an interesting compromise between Democratic members of that committee, including Representative O'Rourke, but a number of other people, and the Republican chair of the committee, Michael McCaul. But I think the best language in terms of the task force itself was in the Senate when 744. There's a lot of problematic provisions in that bill, but one thing that there was this language about a border oversight and accountability task force.
Great. Can we move on to the next question, please?
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and 1 on your touchtone phone. And we do have a question from Lourdes Medrano with the Christian Science Monitor. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, there's been a lot of other studies that show findings of mistreatment among migrants. What would you say is different about this study?
So I think that, Jeremy, can you take this question, please?
Sure. I would say first off is the methodological rigor that we bring to this discussion. Because it's a systematic survey, because it's a random sample, the level of confidence is much higher. And we also bring a lot more depth in the analysis in terms of breaking down what types of abuses occur, what types of agencies are involved. And these are the two kind of main things that we're putting forward today. Which brings out a lot of issues that are really concerning, and particularly types of abuses that are really almost impossible to justify within a normal law enforcement interaction. And so this includes, extreme uses of force, sexual abuse, as well as types of verbal abuse that are exceedingly common, including racial remarks, other things that simply cannot be justified as part of a professional interaction between law enforcement and people.
Thank you, Jeremy.
I'd also, this is Dan Martinez, I'd also just like to add that while, these two reports focus on mistreatment, whether it's physical and verbal abuse or possessions being taken and not returned, this study actually was a much larger project, right? So we focused on everything from the reasons why people decide to leave their communities of origin in Mexico, up through the trajectories north to the border, their crossing experiences into the United States, whether or not they successfully arrived at their destination or not, their time spent living and working in the United States, the extent of their social networks and contacts in the United States. And so this study is a sociological study aimed at better understanding the mechanisms and processes that shape unauthorized crossing experience itself, not just focused on documenting abuse, right? So this is part of a much larger, rigorous social scientific project.
I haven't had a chance to review the report yet. Did you break it down by gender? Women?
Not in this report, no. Okay. I think we have some of the gender breakdowns in our first overview report, which you can find on the University of Arizona Latin American Studies website. There's a link to that in the report too. Dan, would you want to talk about any of that?
I think I could probably return to that in a second. I could look at some of these differences, but actually maybe for the time being, given the limited time that we have, maybe that's a conversation maybe we could have independently perhaps. One thing I would like to say is just that this is just kind of the first step. Jeremy and Professor Hyman and I are all planning on actually writing an academic paper, kind of looking at some of the important differences, not just at the individual level, but also the agency level, to help explicate some of these differential abuses that people experience. So for the time being, I just want to note that I would point you to the report that we released. It's available on the website, the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Arizona. There's some breakdown there in terms of gender differences, in terms of the crossing experience. And just to kind of give you a better understanding, the majority, as with most border crossers, the majority of our sample are males, right? So it's actually consistent with apprehension statistics as well as with Inami repatriation stats in terms of that gender breakdown. So among those who experienced abuse, likely again overwhelmingly male, but there has been some abuse of women as well that we picked up.
All right, thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch tone phone. We'll go next to Daniel Gonzalez with the Arizona Republic. Go ahead, your line is open.
Could you please talk a little bit more about how the study was done, how the research was done, who was doing it? So I know you said it was in six different cities. So were there teams of people who traveled from city to city, or one team went to one city, one team went to another city, and who were these people who were actually asking the questions?
That's a really good question.
I can start on that if you want.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I was the guy in charge of doing a bunch of that. So we actually had six different teams, and it was a completely binational project with both Mexican nationals and U.S. nationals and Mexican-Americans involved. And so we would generally we had one team in Tijuana that was from there. It was a mix of people from the U.S. and people from Mexico. Our team in Mexicali was primarily from Mexico. And this was related to the Colegio de Frontera Norte. Our teams in Tijuana was the Colegio Frontera Norte and with San Diego State University. We ran the team in Nogales right out of the University of Arizona, which was students from the Latin American Studies program mainly, as well as students from the Universidad Autónoma de Sinaloa. And then in Ciudad Juárez, it was the team was from the Universidad Autónoma de Ciudad Juárez. And in Nuevo Laredo, it was from the Colegio de Frontera Norte as well. And so my job was to go to all the cities, help set up a team, train people in the survey methodology, the protocol, what the survey instrument, how to use the survey instrument, and make sure that we had appropriate access. We generally did the majority of the surveys in the shelters because we wanted a place where we could sit down and talk to people for more time. It was about an hour long each interview. So we really wanted to build a place that's safe, a place that's comfortable, so that people would open up and tell us more detail about their experiences. In Mexico City, we did them in the bus station because we were really interested in testing one of these programs, which is when it's called the Mexican Interior Repatriation Program, where during the summer months, people are flown from Arizona all the way to Mexico City. And so we wanted to get a little bit about that program, and we did less interviews there. We did about 200 interviews everywhere and about 75 in Mexico City.
And then one other quick thing. You mentioned that I saw there was a small percentage of people who complained that they had been victims of sexual abuse. Can you give some examples of what that was?
This is Dan Martinez. Just in terms of, so if you think about it, it's, you know, with that percentage, it was like 3%. So we're talking about just a few handful of cases, but it was inappropriately touching during searches. Being pat down, what they perceive to be maybe excessively or aggressively, or being touched inappropriately. And it was mostly, you know, it was women, right? It was female migrants saying that they felt that the way in which they were searched was taken too far.
And often being searched by men as well.
Yes, correct. And this is Joe Hyman. Related to that is another set of verbal abuses that involved insults that were specifically aimed at people's sexuality. And one of the striking things about the verbal insults is because of the content of them, we can often say that these things have absolutely no place in a law enforcement activity. Why somebody who is trying to ascertain the citizenship and immigration status of a person at the point of apprehension would need to say anything about their sexual orientation. That's just, it's absolutely unacceptable. And the organization needs to deal with those kinds of attitudes. The verbal statements are oftentimes very revealing of problematic attitudes.
All right, thank you very much.
This is Dan Martinez again. If I could just go back and make a comment about gender differences in terms of people experiencing abuse. I was looking at the data right now. This is not in the report, but I can tell you that in terms of physical abuse, there's no statistically significant difference between males and females. So, for instance, women report 11% of our female respondents report being physically abused by the agent or by U.S. authorities or while in U.S. custody, compared to 10.9%. So there's no statistically significant difference. They're both 11% report of physical abuse. When it comes to verbal abuse, 31% of female respondents indicated they've experienced some kind of a verbal abuse or harassment, compared to 22% of male respondents. So there does appear to be an important gender difference when it comes to verbal abuse or verbal harassment.
And once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone.
Can I add real quick to that, too? I mean, one of the things to keep in mind and to clarify with all of this stuff is that it might not sound like a lot, 10%, but when the Border Patrol is apprehending over 400,000 people a year, this is a large number of people that have these. So this is a huge number of incidents. With the percentage, it might sound small, but in terms of, like, the scope of the problem, this is much, much larger.
And going back to something that Joe just mentioned, you know, there's no place for this type of verbal harassment or abuse, let alone the physical abuse, but there's no place for this type of verbal abuse in the workplace, right? If I were to, you know, treat my coworkers in that way, or if I were to talk to, you know, students or you know, people who are, you know, part of the custodial staff on campus in that way, it's completely unacceptable, right? So there's no place for these types of comments and remarks that we see that are quite pervasive and systematic. There's just no place for it, you know, in the workplace, let alone, you know, representatives of you know, our federal government.
Thank you. I think we can move on to the next question.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone.
Maybe I could expand on the gender differences really quick while we're waiting. I think one of the things that might speak to as well is that I think men can be very reluctant to acknowledge some of these abuses. So I just want to stress again that these are conservative numbers. I feel like especially in terms of verbal abuse, a lot of men kind of think that this is standard when it really shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, kind of going, you know, I don't want to turn this into an academic discussion, but if we look at David Spiener's important work that he's done, you know, along the U.S., the Texas, northeastern Mexican border, so David Spiener talks quite a bit about the normalization of suffering, right? And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of Mexican migrants have done. And generally speaking, a lot of, we're seeing, you know, historically, migration from Mexico has been male-dominated. More recently, we've seen an uptick in the number of, or the percent of women trying to cross, and we see it represented within our sample that there are more first-time crossers that are female compared to first-time crossers that are male. And so for a lot of more experienced Mexican migrants, male Mexican migrants, you know, that normalization process might be occurring. It's not necessarily justified. It doesn't make it right, but that helps us understand some of those important gender differences.
Thank you, Dan. So do we have any more questions?
And Mr. Cantor, there are no questions at this time.
Okay.
Can I make one other comment?
Actually, pardon the interruption. We do have one late question from Paul Barbie with No More Deaths. Go ahead. Your line is open.
Is it possible to get a link to the articles instead of that I can broadcast to our people so we can find the report easily if that
Hi.
Emailed
yeah.
out?
Yeah, sure. If you would like to, you know, I can give you my email address if you want to respond to that, or you can give me your email address and I can send it right now if you'd like.
Okay, my email.
You mean the link to the report that we'll release today?
Yes.
Yeah, it's
already posted on our website. It's immigrationpolicy.org, so you can access them there.
I'm sorry, there was talk over. I couldn't understand that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm saying that the reports are already available on our website, which is immigrationpolicy.org.
Okay. That's what I need. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we do have a follow-up question also from Daniel Gonzalez with Arizona Republic. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Just quickly, who funded the study? And also, would it be possible for you to put me in touch with any of the people who were interviewed? Do you have any contact phone numbers where I could actually try to call one or two people who were interviewed as part of this study?
The part of the funding came, the majority of the funding came from Ford Foundation, the Ford Foundation. As far as trying to contact people who were interviewed, this is, you know, the reality is that we, you know, all of our, as part of dealing with human subjects, you know, in the Institutional Review Board at a university, part of that whole process of dealing with human subjects is making sure that you reduce potential harm to your subjects. So all of our surveys are what we call de-identified, right? So we don't ask for identifying information, especially when we're talking about people's, you know, future crossing intentions, whether or not they intend to cross next week into the United States, abuse they may have experienced or whatnot. It's really important as you know, a social scientist and as an academic to maintain the anonymity of our subjects. So for those purposes, we did not collect identifying information of our respondents, and which that tends to be standard, you know, standard protocol, standard procedure among all academics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Can I make a comment really quick on something kind of an aside? Just something that to add on to the possessions issue. I mean, this can become a really critical issue in places along the border that are experiencing significant amounts of border violence. So if you don't have your ID, right, you can't get a wire transfer, you can't get certain government services, and you can't get even a job in a lot of places. So a lot of people wind up getting stuck at the border, and it becomes easier for them maybe even to cross into the U.S. than it does for them to go back home. So a lot of the policies here, especially in areas that are undergoing a lot of conflict, is to try and get people out of the cities as fast as possible. But a lot of people still get stuck here. And it's especially people that have their identifying documents taken away and not returned by U.S. authorities. And so this is a huge problem that I think needs a lot more attention.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to get in the way of anybody who's asking questions, but I wanted to go back to one of the questions that was asked earlier, which is what's the difference between this and previous studies? And I thought the answer as to what the difference is, this is very scientifically systematic, and so therefore it's valid and reliable. I think that was answered well, but I would also say that previous studies that have documented abuses and previous reports that have documented abuses could have been questioned. You know, do we really believe that these things are happening, or are we just looking at dramatic cases? And what's really important about this release, I would underscore this, is that we have confirmed that many years of expressions of concern are in fact supported through using a method that did not go in with any sort of presupposition about what was happening.
And Ms. Lee, Esther Lee with Think Progress has a question. Please go ahead.
Hi. So I was able to access the report about 20 minutes ago, and I haven't read it, and I feel bad about that. But will you guys be available later for me to ask questions? And if so, may I have your email addresses or your phone numbers?
Hi, Esther. I'll go ahead and coordinate that. This is Wendy Felice. If you can just email me, I will coordinate and get you back in touch with people.
Thank you, Wendy.
Great.
Do you have any more questions?
And there are no more questions at this time.
Okay. Well, if there are no more questions, we'll end this call here. And once again, the reports are available on our website, immigrationpolicy.org. For further information, or if you have additional questions, please feel free to contact Wendy Felice at 202-507-7524. That is 202-507-7524. Thank you all for joining us on this call, and have a good day. Bye-bye.